Welcome to the Parent Equation Podcast with me, Aisha Murray. This podcast series is full of inspiring stories from working parents who are passionate about designing a life that works for them and their families. Working parents like you who want a purposeful, rewarding career alongside a balanced family life. So today on The Parent Equation, I'm joined by Tova Lee. Tova is a writer, performer and creator and many other things, but three words is enough. So welcome, Tova.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And the reason, I suppose the main reason I wanted to get you on, Tova, is because my podcast was designed to normalize parenthood, to normalize being a working parent, to normalize the expectations that we all put upon ourselves and external expectations that we all sort of suffer from daily. And your approach to life and to parenthood is absolutely, how do we normalize it? How to bring everyone down to the same level and be able to live our lives based on who we are and our, as you said before, our authentic selves. How can we be more authentic? So it really aligns with my vision for my podcast too. So I think the first question we're going to ask is, why do you think we set ourselves these, I suppose, self-imposed expectations as a woman, as a mother, for this context of this podcast?
Yes, I think that last bit was very important to add, because I don't know if that's something that men do as much, or fathers. I don't know if that's in my book or not, but I have this great story about how I realized that mom guilt was really just mom guilt rather than dad guilt. Mm-hmm. Having sort of messed up with getting my daughter's birthday assembly wrong, and my husband Mike being in the exact same boat as I was, and me feeling awful about it, but him being able to see the silver line, which was that we then dropped everything and ran and made it in time. Mm-hmm. He was able to give himself that pat on the shoulder, like, I'm a great parent because I did that. And I was a bit like, I'm the worst parent because I forgot to begin with.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is probably has to do with some sort of society pressure that is placed more so on women than it is on men. I know that for me personally, I definitely did feel that earlier on in my journey as a mm-hmm. parent, that I needed to live up to some sort of role model that I had, I don't know, seen, made up in my mind. I don't know. And it was so not me. I mean, it was so, it had nothing to do with me as a person, my personality. And it really did start from a very early on stage. even, you know, in the baby stage, when my first daughter was born, I've spoken about this before. Mm-hmm. My maternal instinct that a lot of people talk about mm-hmm. and sort of just make you think that everybody has it, and it just kicks into gear and it's so normal, blah, 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 blah. It didn't feel that way for me. My journey, my process was totally different. And immediately I felt like something was wrong with me. There wasn't even a chance for me to enter motherhood on like a good note, because immediately I thought, well, hang on a minute, this superpower that I've read about my entire life, mm-hmm. I don't possess. So that means I'm an awful mother, because mm-hmm. I'm supposed to have this and I don't. And then from there, it just added on, like different things, you know, those brochures of mothers kind of like all dressed in white. Like, who bakes in white? I don't even understand.
Who bakes at all?
Who bakes at all? Like, yeah. So all those things. And I hated them. I hated messy play. I hated baking. I hated all of it. And yeah, there were a good few years, I think, of a real struggle. Of just trying to fit in and trying to hide how I was feeling, trying to be something that I wasn't, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know. I don't know. I'm hoping that today, do you think today maybe things are a little better? I think there's definitely more people out there talking about this yeah. than was back in the day. And even when I first became a mom, which was 2011, mm-hmm. there were people talking about it, but not as much. And now I think it's a bit more, the conversation is...
Yeah, there's definitely more, people are giving themselves permission to talk about yeah. it more without feeling like they're going to be judged. I think that's the main thing. I think when I was similar, my oldest daughter was born in 2010, so similar to you. And it was a fear of the judgment. Same with you. I cannot stand messy play and crafts, my house getting messed up and Play-Doh in the carpet. But then there's a judgment of, am I then being a good mum? But I think that's lessening because people are feeling more comfortable talking about it like we are today.
And also just, I think, imposing on other people what we think is the right thing is also a bit problematic because it's, you know, it might be right for you.
Yeah.
Poor child, you know, but I don't know if it's right for me, and I don't know if it's right for my child, who you don't know.
Yeah. So how did your, I suppose, your working parent journey change? Because I suppose, and you can tell me now, but you had a professional career in law initially,
yeah,
and then you moved into sort of performance content space. When did your children come along in that journey?
No, so they, I mean, yeah, I did things obviously before they were born. When my first daughter was born, I was still an actress. So I was still doing the old, like, you know, schlepping to auditions, and I did an Oedipus show when she was really little and she came up to Oedipus with me. So that was, you know, that was obviously for anyone who's in that field, it's a challenge because you're, you know, you come to your casting with your baby and the baby beyond and ask someone to hold your baby while you go. So I've done that. And then when we found out we were having twins, I sort of thought, okay, that's it. Like, it's not going to work, you know? And also I wasn't really making enough money and we were sort of surviving off my husband's salary. And at that point, I thought, okay, I need to go back to work and earn money because we're going to need it, you know? So at that point, I looked for a job that was going to be convenient with the demands of parenting. And so it wasn't so much about what the job was going to be. What I was interested in were the hours, where it was based.
Yep.
Like, I wanted it to work around, you know, me being a mother. So it was great. It was a local job in an office. The hours were super friendly. It was a family business. They really understood the whole, you know, school run and oh, I have to drop everything now and take my daughter, you know, the nursery just rang me. I have to go. Sorry. Bye. And it was a really good, it was, you know, it was great for a time. At the same time, slowly, bit by bit, my soul was getting crushed because I really hated it. And there was no outlet for my creativity or anything. And at the same time, I started my blog, which really started as a hobby and as an outlet. And I just wanted to put things out there. And going back to the parenting and sort of, I used comedy a lot in my videos, which were all about parenting, by the way. They're not anymore, but they used to be all about parenting. So I would on purpose, like, label my videos really kind of annoying titles, like, I love my kids, especially when they're asleep.
Yeah.
I love my kids, but I wish they would fuck off. You know, like, it was really provoking on purpose because I thought, actually, that's the point of comedy, is to take something that's very genuine, because we all have those moments that we wish they would piss off, but take them to the extreme and really, really annoy the people who find it so offensive that a mother would, you know, dare to say something like that. But I guess that that type of strategy works for me because my videos went viral. It was, you know, hate it. In the online world, obviously, it's very hard to deal with, and it's not a laughing matter. However, you know, it also reads as high engagement, and it does mean that your stuff gets out there. So that's kind of what happened. I suddenly had this massive platform that I was dedicating a lot of time to, but not actually earning money from. And at the same time, I was still doing that office job and obviously being a parent. So that was when I decided to quit the office job and make this into my full time.
And is this the new full time that you're talking about now?
Yeah.
Is this, presumably, this is no longer crushing your soul?
No, no. So elements of it probably still are, because, you know, like anything, you have to, within this, you have to navigate like a lot of things. So I love the creativity. I love the fact that I can work from the hours that I want in my house, all of that. I love the fact that I get to reach a lot of people with very important messages. Like, you know, now I do much more women's stuff and feminine them, and that's what I'm really passionate about. But at the same time, any job, you have to find ways to earn your living, and the media doesn't pay its creators, so you have to find other ways to do that. And that brings into the equation working with brands and doing all that stuff, and I'm not a fan of that world at all. But I do it because that's what pays my bills, and that's what allows me to put out the content that I do. And I put out so much content because I'm able to afford it.
Yeah, I think it's an enabler, isn't it? And I think a lot of the conversations I have with mums who are thinking, similar to you, something is crushing my soul here and this can't be it forever. Surely there's more to life.
Yeah.
And it does, up to your point earlier, it does seem to be the majority of women who have this view rather than the men. You know, we can go into that, I'm sure, at a different time. So it's the women saying, oh, there must be something more to this life now. I need a new purpose as a working mum. I'm not quite sure what it is. But it's realising, as you just said, there are enablers that you might have to kind of latch onto to enable you to pursue a passion or a motivation. You don't have to chuck everything out, baby in the bathwater. It's finding a sort of combination of things that could work for you that fuel your passion but also pay the bills.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's obviously, you know, that's the dream, isn't it? It's not, I mean, I feel very fortunate because this wasn't planned, sort of presented itself. But then again, I also took it and ran with it. I sometimes think that I should change, you know, you mentioned those three words on my bio. I should just write hustler, because that's what I feel describes me more than anything. But I also think that most women are hustlers. Like, I feel like we just adapt, you know. I talk about it a lot in my one woman show. I talked about it a lot, about how women, you know, you mentioned imposter syndrome. I know you were going to another about imposter syndrome. And I have a theory about it, that it's actually a result of the fact that as women, we reinvent ourselves. So many times our careers don't go in one straight line. You don't like join a company and promotion, another promotion, another promotion, another promotion, retirement and die. You know, you sort of,
so that sounds fun.
Yeah, I know, but it's true. I think for a lot of, you know, traditionally speaking, for a lot of men, that's the journey. Whereas for women, you know, once you become a mother, it's still a fact. You then sort of, you do an adapt, and then they're a bit older, you adapt again, and then they have to reinvent yourself. And most of my friends, they've gone from one career to another to sort of, and that's how it's happened for me as well. But that's an amazing skill to be able to adapt that way, to reinvent yourself. Like it's so hard, but it's such an amazing skill to be able to do that.
So I suppose to your point around imposter syndrome, if we acknowledge that we are reinventing ourselves successfully, we have built resilience because we can change, we can adapt, we can see where we are and change things up. Surely if we acknowledge that, that should release or reduce some of this imposter syndrome, because we should be celebrating what we're achieving.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think for anybody out there who is feeling imposter syndrome, I can tell you, as someone who, like you said, came from a corporate world where I was, you know, an attorney, and you know, I used to go to court and represent people and wear the suit. And I used to feel like it was such a show. It's so BS. I mean, it's such BS. Underneath all our degrees and all our suits and all our whatever, like, we're all exactly the same. Like, everybody has their insecurities. Some people just hide it so much better, and I think that links into the whole fake it till you make it approach, which I think is a great tool, by the way, and I used to use it a lot, and then at some point felt like, okay, I want something else too. And that's kind of where it went back to being authentic, because actually being able to say, I'm feeling insecure now because this is the first time I'm pitching this idea to of people, so just going to acknowledge that now and have that authentic moment with yourself and even maybe with your peers if it's appropriate, actually relieves that anxiety in I think a much better way than walking into the room and go fake it till you make it and having that kind of type, which again does work, and I do still use it sometimes, but just to have that other tool. And it was my daughter who was 9 at the time, who actually gave me that advice, like, so smart. I did my first one woman show, and I had never done anything like it. It's so different from, you know, being an actress. Mm. You perform other people's words. Mm. Most of the times it's known work, so you know that it works, you know. Whereas here I wrote a whole script and I didn't know if it would work. And I was so nervous. And my daughter said to me, but why don't you just say that? Why don't you just tell the audience how you feel? And I was like, oh, wow, that's like, what? And that's what I did. It was like nearly the first thing that I said when I came on stage. And immediately everybody gets on your side because everybody's had that.
Yeah.
Everybody's had that moment. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants you to do well. And you're showing your vulnerability, which I think is so courageous. So I would tell people, yeah, to take that deep breath and just be authentic is to approach those moments.
Because do you not think that fake it till you make it needs quite a lot of confidence? To be able to step into that room with the shoulder pads on and, you know, dynasty hair, whatever it is, and go, I can nail this. I am strong. I'm a strong, independent woman. I'm a lawyer. That, to me, takes confidence to put yourself out there, faking it or not.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably.
Whereas the vulnerability, in theory, if you can allow yourself to express it, should be easier.
Yeah, but I think it's so much braver, no? And maybe that has to do with what, again, society has taught us about vulnerability. A lot of the times it's associated with weakness, when actually I think, God, it's so much scarier. I think, you know, for a lot of people, showing vulnerability is a far, far, far scarier thing than going into pretending to know all the answers. Mm-hmm.
We both have daughters. They're both bringing up, hopefully, young, independent women into this world. Do you think, from what you see and from what your daughter said about being authentic, do you think there's a shift in that perception, and that hopefully our daughters now, our younger daughters, will grow up in a society which allows them to be anything they want to be rather than sort of pigeonholed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a movement, you know, you see it in certain things, but like everything, I don't think it moves in one direction. It sometimes feels like you go forward, then you go back, then, you know, it's like you're sideways. So I don't know if it's like just going forward, but I feel like in some ways, yes, we are. I think that there's still a long way to go. I think that if you have the look, someone wrote actually a comment on my video, and she said, I'm raising an independent girl, and, you know, she knows she can do whatever she wants, blah, blah, blah. I don't think me buying her a princess t-shirt is going to change that. And obviously that's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. Not the single t-shirt that's going to make the difference between, you know, that's not it, but it's not even just the clothes. It's so more than that. It's subliminal messages that we get from so many different places. The clothes is just one of them. And what is interesting to me is that I love it when someone says to me, I never thought of that, because that's great that now you're going to think about it. Just think about it. I remember when I started noticing, we all know what sexism is, and we can all very easily notice blunt sexism. Like if you see an ad now, I mean, you wouldn't see it now, but let's say once upon a time, you'd see an ad for, I don't know, beer or car, and the girl is bent over and the guy is slapping her on the bum. Then, you know, you'd know that is sexist, right? But there are levels of sexism that have become such a norm in society that they are far harder to see unless you are aware of them. So for me, I realized, and it wasn't so long ago, honestly, it wasn't, you know, this is a few years ago, I suddenly started seeing these things far more than I ever did. And it's not because they're worse. If anything, they're not as bad as they were 20 years ago. But 20 years ago, they went over my head because I thought, oh, well, that's just the way it is. You know, I didn't think about it. I didn't question it. So I think just having these conversations and opening our eyes to it at least makes us question it, and also know that we have a choice. yeah, just know that we have a choice. We don't have to consume those products. We don't have to buy those books. We don't have to watch those films. I am that very annoying mother who kind of has ruined most Disney movies for my kids. It always comes with a commentary and I have to pause it and have a whole discussion. They hate watching Disney because
they just want to get on with it regardless.
Oh yeah, for sure. They're like, okay, we get it. It's sexist. Okay, can we watch it? For sure. But at least I did something. Do you know what I mean? I did something.
and that something will just sow a seed in their minds, won't it? It doesn't, you know, they don't necessarily have to enter into a half an hour debate around it, but just the fact you've mentioned it will sow a seed that they will process as they need to, and they'll go with it because they're independent young women and they'll decide for themselves what they want to think.
It's nice
sowing that seed.
It's nice when you hear, like they said to me, this was before we left the UK actually, that they were playing football, sort of like in the recess or whatever. And they were playing boys and girls together. And these were my 9-year-olds. And then one of the girls scored a goal. And a boy said to the boy that she managed to score the goal and said, ha ha, a girl scored a goal against you. And then, of course, she immediately knew, like, what? Like, that's sexist. No. But before she could even say anything, another boy called him up.
Interesting.
And said, no, that's sexist. So what if she's a girl? She's a good football player. Okay. You know that. And I was like, I love that story. I was so happy. So I think hopefully having these conversations with our children, not just the girls, obviously boys as well, will make a difference because they're going to be the adults, you know, they're the next generation. Like, and it's, it has to start when you're small.
Well, that seed is being sown then. That's a very good example of it. Is something is happening
in that
space. And you know, 9 years old, they've got plenty of time still before adulthood.
Yeah.
To formulate those thoughts even more deeply and positively, we hope.
I hope so.
So you've recently moved from the UK. You mentioned the UK just then. So you've moved from the UK to Portugal.
Yeah.
And everyone says, like, oh, wish I could do that. Oh, maybe I should do that. And we talked before we started recording that you obviously had to take your 3 kids with you, ideally, even though you want them to piss off, you couldn't leave them back in the UK. How did that, again, I think it's something that not just moving country, but we often think about big changes in our lives that we want to make our family lives happier or more balanced, whatever it is, or for work. And we think, you know, can our kids cope with a change like this? And you've done it on a bigger scale because you've moved country. So language, culture, physical location, etc. How do you think you took your kids on that journey?
So again, I don't know for other people, but you know, each family is different and you have to do obviously what's right for your family. I think for us, it did come from me. I have moved a lot in my life. Obviously, I'm not from the UK, so I've already had a big move, which I did when I was 30. But even before, when I lived in Israel, I had moved areas in Jerusalem when I was little, so I had to move to another school when I was 10. And that was my big move. And first time that I had to sort of find new friends, you know, and there were a lot of moments in my life that I had to sort of start over, you know, this kind of like, you know, I remembered the move when I was 10 as quite difficult, actually, because that was the first time. But I also believe that all of those experiences made me someone who is not scared of starting and not scared of, okay, going to another country and now we need to make new friends and we need to make a new life, you know, and I love change. I love it. My husband, Mike, is the complete opposite. Like, he could not be more opposite if he tried. He has lived, and he's 55 now, his entire life in the same area in North London. So he didn't even move out of the area. Where he grew up is up the road from where we have lived for the past 13 years. So for him, it was massive. I think for the children, we presented it to them, and this was genuine, that we would do, this was an adventure. This was not for life. We would go for 2 to 3 years, have an adventure, like a long holiday, and come back. And if we hated it, we could come back sooner. And if we loved it, we could stay longer. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like the approach, which I think really helped because my children were happy where they were. Mm-hmm. They were in a school that we as parents and adults thought was awful, but they as children didn't see the things that we thought were awful about the school and loved it because their friends were there. Mm-hmm. You know, they see it through their eyes, but the things we wanted from that for them, we knew we couldn't give them in where we were in London. And the timing was also not a coincidence because my eldest was just going to go to secondary school. So it was a reshuffle. The place she was going to go to was very far from where we lived. So there was a good chance that we would have ended up moving anyway. Yeah. And not necessarily to somewhere as nice as Portugal. And also, if I'm being honest, and I know a lot of people have gone through this in the pandemic, I think being trapped in and, you know, and just having people, so many people pass away, and Mike had a friend passed away, not from COVID, but during the pandemic, and he was very young, just made us kind of think, oh God, like, you know, that idea of let's save our entire life so that when we're 65, we can move by the coast. So can we just do that now? Can we do it at 45? I'm 46, but we started the conversation. So can we do it at 45? And then at 65, I don't think I'm going to care where I am. let's just see what happens. So it was a bit of, I don't know if I believe in that theory anymore, that you work your entire life so that when you're old, you can have a nice life and actually live the way you want. I was like, I kind of want to live the way I want now.
While you've still got your faculties, why not?
Yeah. But of course, you know, taking into account, you know, we're very lucky because we both work completely remotely. So where we are in the world makes absolutely no difference to our income. And that is great for us. And I know it's not everybody's situation, but you know, that was it. It was a bit like, well, why not actually? Mm-hmm.
I think that's the key phrase is let's just see.
Yeah, let's just see.
Let's just see.
I have someone, there's an actress in Israel who did a similar move with her family to Greece. And they did a documentary about it. And one of the sentences she said in the documentary really stuck with me because, you know, I've had my wobbles throughout this time before the move. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about this for literally nearly 2 years. So I've had like, oh, do we want to do it? Maybe we shouldn't do it. Oh, you know, all that. And when things are a bit, and I watched this documentary and it was her children because they're so smart. Said to her, she was having this wobbles and all that. And they said to her, just, you know, just like go with the flow. So if it's not good, we'll come back. Like it was like she couldn't get her head around the fact that actually it doesn't have to be for life, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was our strategy. We didn't sell our house. We kept it in the UK. We're renting here. Mm-hmm. We didn't buy anything. Mm-hmm. So it feels very still kind of, we can change, go back. We don't like it.
How
we love it. So
and that's the thing for anybody, and like you said, we can't all necessarily move country, or we can't all, you know, there are things we have our own constraints and realities we have to deal with, but and it might just be something quite small that you change that can have a really big impact potentially.
Yeah,
but it's just opening your eyes and just seeing, what if I did that, you know, just test it out, see what, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah. And also the idea of, you know, I know a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, we're not going to do that until the kids are older and they leave home. And I'm always thinking like, but why? You know, I wanted to do this with them. Like, do you know what I mean? I'm like, thinking, actually, it's great. We're I read a lot of blogs of people who have done similar things, or actually much more extreme, you know, like they're just traveling around the world. You know, that was my first idea. Let's just travel around the world. And then Mike is a bit like, no, like that's not us. That's too much. And he's right. We would kill him. It would be. Plus we have three dogs. I mean, it would really be too much. But they all said that it's such a, it made them so much closer as a unit, because you face new challenges, and we do every day. And they're not big, big challenges, because, you know, we're in Portugal, some remote, you know, whatever, we're in lovely Portugal. But it's still, like you said, it's the new call. It's a different culture, the language barrier. Things are done a bit differently here. You know, like processes are different. Bureaucracy is different, you know. You have your daily challenges. So actually doing it as a family, I feel, will bring us closer, and already has. And that's great.
I'm really happy with that. And like you said, the evidence is there for your childhood when you moved, and you moved again when you're 30. And that has made you potentially more resilient person, more adaptable, embracing change rather than fearful of change.
Yeah.
So you know from your own experience that taking your kids through that when they're at the right age, younger age, will build up their resilience and their adaptability as they grow older.
I hope so. I really do. And I think also saying to ourselves that we're only here for a limited amount of time, which I don't know if that's going to be the case or not, but at this point, that's what we're saying, I hope is going to motivate us to really make the best of it while we're here. Because it's very easy to, you know, just fall back into living the same life that you did in North London, but just doing it in better weather.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the point. Like, we really wanted to travel more, to see the area, to, you know, branch into Spain, but we also wanted to just have a completely, like, a new lifestyle and more outdoorsy and try new things. And that was the whole point. So, yeah.
And then you can bring those things. If you want to come back, you want to come back, but you can bring some of that back with you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's all there, embedded in your memory, embedded in your life experience. So you just bring some of that back to North London, if that's what happens, not the weather.
And sometimes you need a big change to kick you into gear. You know what I mean? Like, to, it just helps somehow, you know?
Yeah. Well, big change for us probably is menopause quite soon. And how I linked Portugal and the sunshine.
I love that.
Menopause. I was thinking about big change. I know you mentioned that in your, so I've been reading your book, Effed at 40, which resonates hugely, I think, with anybody of our age and all the things that happen to us and expectations. So just before we wrap up today, I suppose, what was your catalyst to writing that? Was it just to get everything off your chest about everything that's happening to you?
Yeah, I think it was I've been asked to write a book, and they wanted me to write a parenting book, a how-to book, and I was like, nah, like, and then in the beginning of my 40s, I went through my midlife crisis, whereby I just thought, okay, the kids were a bit older, and I'm like, what's left of me? That kind of trying to reconnect with the different layers, you know, of you as a woman. So there was a lot of exploration, my sexuality, you know, my sense of adventure. And I did this massive bucket list and I went out and did it. And after I did all of that, I thought, now I have a book. I want to write about it now. So that's kind of what the book is, why the book came about. And it has resonated with a lot of women who have felt maybe trapped, or maybe like they've put their life on the shelf because they've got the kids. And I think, again, that's what we're told we're supposed to do, or expect to do, or feel responsible to do. I don't know. If I could have gone back, by the way, I would have probably not put it on the shelf for as long as I did. I feel like I could have slowly taken it off the shelf much sooner.
Yeah. You're right. So again, it's that guilt, isn't it? If we can't, while we've got young kids, especially younger kids, we're not allowed to put ourselves on the agenda. We can't. We've got too much to deal with. We've got kids that need us. We've got spouses, families, dogs, work, everything else that needs us. So we can't possibly say that we need a bit of time for ourselves.
Totally. And I think also at the end of the day, like parenting is not, I know for a lot of people, they solo parent or they're single parent, but parenting, I think, you know, needs to be a collective if and when possible. So whether it's a partner, if there's a partner in the picture, or any other support or, you know, support that there is. But yeah, doing it all alone is impossible. Like I think it's a recipe for, you know, a nervous breakdown. So again, for us, that was a bit, I mean, I'm all for like get help, any help you can, whether it's hired help or, like I said, family and support system. But yeah, partners are not help, but all of that. Yeah, absolutely.
And that links back to the vulnerability point we said earlier, you know, being more vulnerable and saying, actually, I need help, just opening up to people and talking. Podcasts are about everything that all the work you do is about raising awareness of topics that we can feel comfortable sharing and getting the support we need. So Tava, thank you so much for joining me today. You mentioned the book already.
Yes.
F'd at 40, Amazon and other retailers, I'm sure. Where else can people find you if they want to find out more about you?
Anywhere on social media, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn. It's all Tova Lee.
All the platforms.
LEIGH.
Perfect. Literally all the platforms have been.
Literally all the platforms.
Well done. That's something that I'm still very much struggling with. It's just one at a time. Thank you so much. And I should say a belated Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, thank you.
The last week or 10 days ago, whenever that was.
Yeah.
Have a wonderful year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years in Portugal, whatever it might be. And we will always welcome you back to London should you wish to return.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Lovely to have you. Thank you, Tova.
Bye.
Bye. To work with me, find out more at aishamari.com, connect with me on LinkedIn, or check out my free resources and quizzes at aishamari.com/resources.